From KCRW, I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food. When Joe and Celia Ward Wallace opened South LA Cafe, they were tired. Tired of waiting for fresh, affordable food options to come to their neighborhood. So they decided to stop waiting and try to make it happen on their own. In November 2019, they opened a bright, cheery 2,200 square foot cafe at the corner of Western Avenue and MLK Boulevard. But South LA Cafe has never been just about the food. The Ward Wallaces are on a mission to fight racial, social, and economic inequality. And as they like to say, they're doing it through coffee, community, and connection. Their next big project? Overseeing the Natural History Museum's entire food and beverage program, including a new cafe that opens this week. Joe and Celia Ward Wallace are the subject of this week's In the Weeds.
I'm Joe Ward Wallace, one of the co-founders of South LA Cafe and South LA.
I'm Celia Ward Wallace. I am the CEO and co-founder of South LA Cafe. I was inspired, along with my husband and partner, Joe Ward Wallace, to open up South LA Cafe because we are residents of the community. My husband's born and raised in South LA. I grew up in the community, a child of community organizers, and we were raising our own children here in this neighborhood. And while we had the privilege to drive outside of our community for food and safe places to gather, we saw that our residents, our neighbors, people all around us didn't have access to those same opportunities, didn't have the same level of privilege, and they were having to go get fast food every day. And when they wanted to do grocery shopping, there was nowhere to go. They were facing racial discrimination and harassment, oftentimes by the police, and they felt unsafe in their own communities. And there wasn't a lot of opportunity for the community to gather and build that connection that's so necessary and vital for a healthy community.
You know, gentrification, we started noticing happening at a more rapid pace in the community, and we wanted to get ahead of it. And I was getting close to retiring, and I said, what would be a better time than now? So we just took a leap and opened up the cafe. What I love about this neighborhood is that the big word, it's, I still feel the community. You know, I still speak to my neighbors. I know my neighbors. When things go wrong in the you know, disasters happen, it seems like this neighborhood just steps up and we take care of each other. It's often, to me, felt like the forgotten neighborhood. It's kind of in the middle. It's between the USC group that's pushing over from the east and the Crenshaw, Leimert area that's pushing from the west. And dab in the middle, it just seems like it's forgotten. And the things that dominate this area are the kinds of food that dominate this area are not necessarily healthy foods. You know, it's basically a food desert.
We're coming up on our 20th wedding anniversary this summer. We met in 1997 and fell in love pretty instantly and began dating immediately. And we had one business or the other, one community initiative or the other over several decades. And we've experienced a lot of highs and a lot of lows, lots of success, but also a lot of failures. We were lucky to be together for over 9 years before we started having children. And so we had a whole lifetime of experience together and building our friendship, building our partnership before becoming parents together. And we are so blessed to have two daughters, Ava and Layla, who are beautiful community leaders. They are our advisory board. They've been founders with us, developing the concept behind South LA Cafe and our market, and now our foundation, and now our hospitality company. They have been involved in every inch of it, and they're a huge part of what we do, and they're a huge part of our why. It was always our intention that South LA Cafe be more than a coffee shop. We envisioned it as a market and a cultural center. We very quickly, once we began the process of opening up South LA Cafe, the coffee shop, there was a very small space nearby in the same mini mall that was previously a supermarket, a little mini market. And Joe came home one day and said, this mini market is closing, but we have the opportunity to open up our own South LA market. What do you think? And as he likes to say, you know, he thought I was going to say, you're crazy and no. But in this moment, you know, the light bulb went on in my head and I said, you know, this is an opportunity for us to extend our mission and extend this impact into our community. What better way to provide access to fresh, healthy, and affordable food than having a mini market on top of everything that we're doing? And so we have this amazing market next door. We have the coffee shop, but the coffee shop is always meant to be a gathering space, a cultural hub. Indoors, you come in and it's black and white everywhere with beautiful photos of the South Central community, as well as a mural of Nipsey Hussle painted by local Black Panther elder Muhammad Mubarak. Recently, we started roasting our own coffee in-house on site with a completely 100% emissions-free green roaster that Joe roasts every day. As far as the food, we have just the most amazing, delicious coffee. And it was always our intention that our coffee would be super accessible for all types of people, whatever their coffee palates were. So whether you're just looking for a great cup of drip coffee, we have a $2 regular cup of coffee. And whether you're looking for, you know, a double espresso of the finest quality espresso you can find, we have that for those people as well. And then one other thing we came up with that, you know, we saw was all over the west side, but not on the south side, was avocado toast. And, you know, if you go anywhere on the west side for avocado toast, you know, you're looking at $12 to $18 for a couple pieces of avocado toast with radishes or, you know, something with it, microgreens. But at our location, we came up with one piece of avocado toast for $3, two pieces for $5. If you get all the works, cheese and tomatoes at $7.50. And if you get eggs on top, you can get out of there for, you know, $10.
And you have to have, if you live in Los Angeles, if you went to LA Unified, you have to have our delicious coffee cake. Every kid that went to LA Unified knows what that coffee cake is. It is the original. We use the exact formula. In January, we embarked on this new venture with the Natural History Museum, which is a major deal.
We're taking over as the food and beverage and catering provider for the next 10 years.
We're making a blueprint for how things are done. And what I mean by that is that normally it's the big companies that get these kinds of contracts. They're the ones that are assumed that they're the only ones that have the infrastructure to pull this off. And sort of a David and Goliath that we came along, we put together our pitch deck to them, just like the big companies did, and we won the contract.
And one of the benefits of this opportunity for us is our first project is renovating the existing grill restaurant on the bottom floor of the Natural History Museum and selecting and bringing in a brand new operator. And so we went about a very rigorous process to interview the best of the best in our community and beyond. And there was no contest. The number one team that beat everybody else out for this opportunity is John and Ronnie Cleveland, who are the owners, operators, and John is the head chef at Post and Beam, which is a James Beard Award nominee restaurant and chef right here located in Baldwin Hills. And so we are working very closely with them on an exciting new concept. We also are going to provide in-house concessions as well as special event vendors. And the exciting thing for us is we have built a network of the most amazing high quality chefs and restaurateurs from our community that have been looking for opportunities to break into the cultural institution space, but for far too long have been kept out by all the reasons we know that are, you know, problems with equity. So this is not just an opportunity for our organization and our families to grow, but it is an opportunity for us to catapult the economic impact and social impact in our communities with those around us.
Joe and Celia Ward Wallace own and operate South LA Cafe at the corner of Western Avenue and MLK Boulevard. It's open 7 days a week from 7 a.m. to 4 p.m. This weekend, they launched their brand new partnership with John and Ronnie Cleveland, Neighborhood Grill by Post and Beam at the Natural History Museum of Los Angeles County. This weekend is the grand opening, so head on down to check out those dinosaurs and grab a hot pastrami sandwich or some vegan tacos. Coming up, mushrooms. We are equally fascinated and terrified of them, and the makers of the hit TV show The Last of Us know that. Stay with us.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Welcome back to Good Food. I love mushrooms. I like eating them, but not nearly as much as I love learning about them. They're mysterious and nearly alien in the way that they grow and the compounds they have. So it shouldn't have been a surprise when they showed up zombified as a main character in a wildly successful series. I admit to being somewhat dismayed, since the public has trouble grasping nuance and loves to fearmonger. Here to talk mushrooms in the context of The Last of Us is Tejal Rao, critic at large for The New York Times. Warning, don't listen if you haven't watched or if you don't want to know the premise of the show. Hi, Tejal.
Hi, Evan.
Do you watch apocalyptic fodder just for entertainment?
I do. I have to admit it. I do. I love a post-apocalyptic show. I love a pandemic, a global pandemic show or movie. I love horror movies. So this combines a lot of that.
Are you hoping to learn something for future survival?
I think that I can't help but go into that mode a little bit when I'm watching these. But at the same time, I am aware, I try to stay aware that it's fiction. You know, that's part of why I was really tickled when I learned that Paul Stamets, who's one of this country's best known mycologists, had watched the first two episodes of this zombie thriller show and then posted about it on Facebook because he felt like he had to emphasize the fact that no cordyceps, a mushroom, well, a kind of parasitic fungus, isn't capable of turning humans into flesh-eating zombies. It's not real. It's just a show. Don't worry.
Yeah. which is nuts when you
think
about it.
It's nuts. And he wasn't the only one. There were so many posts, you know, right after that first episode came out. And the first episode is quite brutal. You know, you witness the world falling into violent chaos. But I kept seeing these posts featuring mycologists and fungal biologists assuring people that, you know, cordyceps can't do this to us. Everyone calm down.
I was sort of upset that they used the name of an actual mushroom that exists in the world as their evil vector.
Yeah, I wonder if the name of the mushroom had been fictional, if people wouldn't have been quite so rattled.
And also, I was fascinated by the idea of the premise of how the pandemic took hold, the way one of the main characters feels that it probably came from a contaminated batch of staple food, like flour or sugar, shipped all over the globe and causes this global pandemic over a weekend.
Yeah, I mean, the industrial food system would certainly be a very efficient way to deliver a pandemic. So it was quite scary and a little too close to, you know, we have such frequent recalls and problems. We're so used to it being in the news that, you know, maybe part of it was that it felt a little too close to reality.
So the vector that zombifies humans in The Last of Us is a very particular mushroom that has been called a zombie fire in and of itself. Can you tell us about this particular mushroom the writers chose to make the main character?
So cordyceps do, you know, there are a bunch of varieties. They do exist in real life and they're parasitic. So they will take over, in most cases, it's ants, but in some cases, other insects. This is going to sound quite horrifying, but they start taking over the insect's brain and essentially turning it into what we consider a zombie. And that's, you know, great for the fungus and terrible for the ant. And the show imagines a very similar cordyceps, a mutation of that fungus that lives in people and spreads from person to person, turning them into a zombie.
You say in your essay that mushrooms have a way of making us consider the things we prefer to avoid. Can you expand on that a bit?
Yeah, you know, mushrooms are complicated, and a lot of people have a fear of mushrooms or tend to find them a little unsettling. And, you know, it's because mushrooms appear at the very end of things. They tend to signal death. They thrive in rot and they bloom in decomposition, and they quite literally work to decay organic matter. And the other way of looking at that process is that it's regenerative, which it is, and it's vital, which it is. But, you know, not everyone wants to think about death that way or to think about death at all. And mushrooms have a sneaky way of making us do that.
At a time when more and more people are interested in foraging and taking classes, and so many people are turning to microdosing and taking various mushroom nutritional supplements, it's odd that our relationship to them is still so fraught.
It's true. It's so complex. I think that this anxiety over mushrooms and over a fictional fungal pandemic maybe reflects this flickering awareness that, you know, we're asking too much of mushrooms. You know, we want them to save us in our day-to-day lives. We want adaptogenic mushrooms, which have been used medicinally for centuries in China and other parts of Asia. We want them to ease our anxiety, help us focus, make us happier, make our skin better, help us go to sleep. Just, you know, we're really relying on them and thinking of them as saviors in a way. And it's true that we know that there are species of fungus that can break down oil in salt water or absorb radiation, clean toxins from the soil. But I don't know if that means it's reasonable to sort of expect them to rescue us from all the damage we're doing to the earth and from climate change. You know, just because they can kind of clean up our messes doesn't mean they want to.
They just want to live.
Yes.
How are some artists trying to change how we see mushrooms?
Yeah, the artist Jay Rim Lee had this wildly popular TED Talk recently about a burial suit that she designed that was seeded with mushrooms. And the idea was to kind of make people think differently about death and its rituals and to have a smaller environmental impact after you die. So the idea is that you would wear this burial suit and kind of invite the mushrooms to decay your body quickly and efficiently and naturally, rather than using all of the chemicals that we use now in burials. And people were absolutely horrified by that idea, and I think thrilled by it too. I think famously a few actors have since used that burial suit, and the artist has actually turned that into a real business since then.
Wow. I love this conversation, and I love even more that it happened because of a post-apocalyptic television show. Thank you so much, Tejal.
Thank you, Evan.
That was critic at large for the New York Times, Tejal Rao, talking about mushroom fear in the context of The Last of Us, which just wrapped its first season. Vsauth Tarak Oak, a.k.a. Chef T, was born in a refugee camp in Thailand to parents who had survived the genocide of the Khmer regime in Cambodia. His family came to the U.S. and settled in Oakland. When he was eight, they moved to Long Beach, a hub for Cambodian immigrants. It's known for its vibrant Cambodia town. There, Chef T learned to cook from his mother and grandmother. After a bit of a winding road, he earned a culinary arts degree from Long Beach City College and worked at several restaurants, eventually becoming the executive chef at Gladstone's in Long Beach. More recently, Chef T has written a cookbook and memoir, Krung, Cambodian Cooking with Chef T. Hi.
Hi, hello. How are you doing?
I'm good. Thank you for coming.
Oh, thank you. Thank you for having me. It's an honor.
In your book, Krung, you write that when you were younger, if someone had told you that you were going to be an executive chef with a thriving culinary career, you wouldn't have believed them. Why not?
No way. I didn't think I could live past 30 back then when I was younger.
Talk to me a little bit more about that.
Well, you know, my lifestyle and how I choose the dark path, you know, gangs, led me to a long, long time of, darkness and a journey that was, you know, just not right.
So what was the pivotal moment that made you take a look at your life, make a change, and sort of turn to the kitchen to feel comfortable?
My sister passed away about 3 weeks before her getting her bachelor's, and I noticed my parents were a little bit weak, and so was my family. So I had this strength, inner strength from somewhere. And mind you, they labeled me the black sheep and all that. So I was the bad kid. But on that day, I did nothing but the things that a righteous person would do. So I decided after that day, I needed to change. And it's just sad that it took my sister's death for mine to start having a life.
You turned, after that event, you re-enrolled in the culinary program at Long Beach City College.
Yes.
But where was that impulse to cook? Where did it come from?
I always loved to cook. I've always been cooking since I was 4 and 5. I've been cooking. I raid my mom and dad's refrigerator all the time. I raided so much they had to put signs up, like, don't touch my food. And this is when I was a kid.
And did your mom and grandma sort of take you in hand and intentionally start to teach you things?
Well, it was mostly more of a watch. So I always liked to watch and learn. I would help them with the small stuff, you know, like cutting the vegetables and stuff like that, picking the herbs. But I knew I was capable of doing more stuff even at a young age. So, and when you're interested in something, you can just tell.
One of the big sort of themes in your book that comes through really clearly is how much pride you have in Long Beach. Tell us about your relationship with the city and why you love it so much, and a bit about what it was like having such a thriving Cambodia town so close to you.
Yeah, it means a lot to me because when I first got here into, Long Beach in America, you know, I didn't know how to really speak English well because my mom, dad, my parents, they didn't know how to speak English. So I grew up, you know, in a household with my first tongue, which is Cambodian, which is Khmer. And when we went to school, we were behind. Most of the kids that was came from Cambodia was behind. So we were getting picked on, we were getting teased on. And, they call me names that I wouldn't dare not say. So Cambodia Town happened to be the second largest Cambodian population in the world beside Cambodia. So I guess we kind of rallied back. So when we rallied back, we formed together and became a brotherhood. which the brotherhood became a gang, and from doing what was right, slowly shifted into doing what was wrong. So it means a lot to me because when I got out and I turned my life around and I go back to the community, the community's not the same no more. They're different. They're not like before. Before it was violence, crimes. It's like you see everybody of different races just holding hands, and that's why I want to give back.
In the introduction to your book, your co-author, Christine Sue.
Yeah, Dr. Christine.
Yeah. She writes that when covering Cambodian cuisine, some reviewers and critics make almost immediate comparisons to Thai, Vietnamese, or Chinese food. Tell me how you feel about that and how you like to describe Cambodian food.
So in history, history of Cambodian, Thai, and Laos, at one point in time, we were one nation. So we were actually just one people, and it started to divide and split. So when it started to divide and split, every region kind of had their own flair, their own, you know, speech, dialects and stuff, and the food a little bit different from Thai and Laos a little bit, because Cambodian used something called kreung. Kreung is a paste from lemongrass, turmeric, galanga, kefir limes, mudfish. So when people hear kreung, they already know that that's Cambodian because everybody got a different version, but Cambodians are the only one that use kreung.
So give us a description of one of your favorite dishes that you like to turn people onto the cuisine with.
I like something called salaw machu kreung. It is a beef stew that's kind of sweet and tart and tangy, but it's very home, it's very earthy, as a dark broth, and you eat it with rice and a little bit of spice. It kind of reminds you of like being around with your grandma and your mom. It's like comfort food. It makes your soul feel good.
Would you like to name check a particular mainstay restaurant of the community or chef that you really love and you'll go to on your day off?
Oh, yeah. I like a restaurant called Phnom Penh Noodle Shack. They're my friends also. I'm not being biased, but the food there, the noodles there to me are the best. The Tan brothers took it over from their parents, and they have not changed anything but made it better. And that restaurant started in 1984, 85, the first one, and it's still here in Long Beach till today, and it's called Noodle Shack, but most people that knows it just call it the Shack.
Oh, I love that. Can you give us another one?
There's also this other place called Crystal Thai and Cambodian cuisine. So it's a mom and pop spot, hole in the wall. You can't touch them. They're so good. This is like 1,000 years past recipe down to them. They still operate with cash only and write down on a piece of paper and stuff like that. It kind of amazes me. Like, yeah, I still operate like that. And then they look at me like, you little hotshot chef, don't tell me what to do. They're wonderful people. And, the authenticity, the flavor, the taste, the texture, the aroma, the smell itself is just like, this is what Cambodia should be.
If people want to start to cook some Cambodian dishes, what are some pantry essentials that they should stock up on?
Okay, most and foremost important, prohok. Prohok is a fermented fish that's been fermented for over a year. And usually they put it into the ground, so it starts to get to the sour and rancid. And then that's when we actually use it. So that's why it kind of throws people off a little bit. And then the most important, besides the mudfish, is lemongrass. That is a very Southeast Asian staple. And also the number one thing that Cambodians use a lot is lemongrass, because in order to make kreung, you need lemongrass.
So if people want to get the mudfish paste, is there a good local store in Long Beach they should go to?
There is a local store in Long Beach. Before, we had like 2, 3, or 4 of them. Now they're down to like about two supermarkets right now. One is called Riverside Market. The other one that shut down was called Kunhang. And the one that's around right now that everybody likes to go to is Kim Long Market on Anaheim Street in the heart of Cambodia town.
It's been so great talking to you. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you so much. It was a pleasure talking to you.
That was Cambodian-American chef Visoth Tarak Oak, a.k.a. Chef T, discussing his cookbook and memoir, Krung, Cambodian Cooking with Chef T, which he co-wrote with Dr. Christine Su. This week, you can explore Cambodia Town's fabulous eats at Long Beach Cambodian Restaurant Week, which runs from March 19th to March 26th. You'll find more info and a link on our website, kcrw.com/goodfood. In a minute, Buko Pai. We talk to the mastermind behind one of my favorite desserts in LA next. You're listening to Good Food on KCRW. I'm Evan Kleiman. To me, a pie is a fruit pie, preferably with two crusts. But I do know that for a lot of you, a pie could be a confection, like a peanut pie or a chocolate pie. Or maybe it's a cream pie with that creamy filling and extravagant top, all swirly, rich, and comforting. Well, you're lucky because joining me is James Beard Award-winning pastry chef Margarita Mansky, co-owner, along with her husband Walter, of Republique, Bicyclette, Mansky, and Sorry Sorry. She's also the author of Baking at Republique, Masterful Techniques and Recipes. She happens to be the best cream pie maker I know, and she's here to drop some knowledge. Hi.
Hi, Evan. Thanks for having me today.
Oh, I'm so happy that you're here. You know, every time I walk past the epic pastry case at Republique, there's always a single cream pie hanging out there. How do you decide what it's going to be each day?
We try to do seasonal pies. So we have Walter, who goes to the farmer's market, brings back fruit. And that's kind of like how we decide what pie to make for the day or for the week or even for the season. You know, that's a big part of it.
So in this season that we've been in, what are a few that you've offered?
Right now, fruit is a little scarce. A lot of it is just citrus right now. But there's also passion fruit that we get fresh from the market. So we've been making the strawberry passion fruit pie right now.
I have to say that your passion fruit pie is my favorite.
Passion fruit really goes well with actually a lot of things. Like I love the balance between the tartness of the passion fruit and then the cream. So those two together, even without any fruit, it's just, you know, and the crust really goes well together.
So let's talk about the components of a cream pie, because there's the bottom crust, the filling, and the top. What is your preference for the bottom crust?
I mean, the bottom crust, we use pâte brisée. So typical pie dough that has a lot of butter. So it gives that flaky crust texture, more light than dense. So that's my preference for the bottom crust.
And do you blind bake them?
We do blind bake it. You know, normally, even with an apple pie, you put the apples in, everything in with the raw pie dough, and then you bake it. But I feel like the crust tends to get a little soggy sometimes and not baked all the way. So even with the apple pies, we, you know, blind bake it a little bit just to make sure that the crust stays crispy.
And then let's talk about the filling, which for me is just the heart of the pie. Your fillings are so, they're amazing because yes, they're rich, but they're not too rich and they're not stodgy in texture. They have a lightness that allows you to feel quite good about finishing the piece of pie.
You don't feel too guilty. Or heavy in the end, right? When you eat a piece of pie.
Yeah, exactly.
I don't know. I mean, I think I love the combination of tart and creamy, sweet. So maybe the tartness aspect of it, you know, doesn't give you such a heavy feeling in the end. Like something cuts through the fat. I also really love putting fresh fruit. I gotta always have something fresh in the pie. So that, again, I think like strawberries or citrus or even raspberries, peaches, whatever fruit we have, has the acidity of the fruit and the freshness of the fruit cuts through all of that fat that we have in there, as you know, cream, butter, sugar. And I think that's what gives it kind of like a lightness, maybe.
So when you make your cream filling, is it basically a pudding? Do you use eggs? Do you use cornstarch? And then do you fold whipped cream into it? Or is it just the custard?
It's just the custard, or we use a lot of curds. Passion fruit curd, lemon curd. You know, we even make a citrus curd. So that normally goes in the bottom of the pie. And then we cover either the custard or the curd with fresh fruit. And then we put the cream on top. So there's different layers to it. You know, you have the crust, and then you have either the custard or the curd, and then the fresh fruit in the middle, and then the cream on top, and then more fruit on top.
Do you have a trick for making your cream on top more stable?
I do, but I don't know if I should tell you. I think I have it in my cookbook anyway. So yeah, it's not a secret. I stabilize it with a little bit of carrageenan. So normally you just, you know, take the cream out of the box, right? And then you whip it. And, you know, for a lot of home bakers or normal people, that's the cream topping. But I learned it from one of my mentors that we put carrageenan, like really, really, really small amount in the cream. And then we activate it by bringing that up to a boil. And then we cool it down. And you can't use it right away. You have to let it sit overnight and set. So the following day, it looks like a panna cotta. And then you whip that. And it really gives you a great silky smooth texture. The only thing is that it, you know, it's easily overwhipped if you don't watch it. So you have to like really stay on it. You can't like turn the mixer on and then walk away, come back. It'll be broken in one, you know, instant. But when it's done right, the texture is unbelievable.
One of our pie categories this year is lineage pie, a pie that tells a story about a person's life. What would your lineage pie be?
That's a tough question. I mean, first thing that comes to mind is the buko pie.
Why don't you describe it for people who have never had it before?
Okay, the bottom crust is a pâte brisée. And then you get, it's made with young coconut. So really tender, fresh coconut. And you fold that in like a coconut pastry cream. That would be the filling, and then the topping would be streusel that's baked in the oven. So again, you get kind of like different layers. You know, you have the fresh coconut, you have the custard, you have the crunchy streusel, you have the nice crust in the bottom. And actually in the Philippines, we serve it with like a pandan creme anglaise to go with it. So you have like a nice sauce to go with the pie.
That buko pie at Sorry Sorry is one of the greatest things to eat in Los Angeles.
Thank you. Really flattered.
So delicious.
No, it gives me, you know, it really fulfills me to hear people say that. You know, I kind of like done something for my country.
I mean, for me, it's not like eating dessert. When I go there to have it, it's the meal. It's just so satisfying. Thank you so much, Margarita.
Oh, you're welcome.
That was James Beard Award-winning pastry chef, Margarita Mansky. She's the co-owner with her husband, Walter, of Republique, Bicyclette, Mansky, and Sorry Sorry. She's also the author of Baking at Republique, Masterful Techniques and Recipes. I love her because she is a darn fine cream pie maker. And yes, Margarita will be a judge at this year's pie contest. Have you entered yet? The big day is Sunday, April 30th at UCLA's Royce Quad. We have 9 categories for you to enter, including a cream chiffon mousse category. Head over to kcrw.com/pie to enter your pie or just RSVP for the event. Whether you're competing or attending, it's going to be a good time. In March, the wind blows down the door and spills my soup upon the floor. It laps it up and roars for more, blowing once, blowing twice, blowing chicken soup with rice. My introduction to an intellectual food life, a curiosity about food that went beyond eating it, came early. Who else read Maurice Sendak and wanted to taste chicken soup while riding a crocodile down the chicken soupy Nile? As I began to read novels without pictures, food descriptions or scenes of set tables and dinner parties were some of my first lessons in differing economic classes. We are what we eat, right? Adrienne LaFrance took a look at some of her favorite descriptions of food and literature for The Atlantic. Hi.
Hi. Thanks so much for having me.
Oh, it's my pleasure, especially since this is one of my favorite subjects. You talk about one of my earliest experiences with food literature, Maurice Sendak's Chicken Soup with Rice. And I have to say, even though I was already 9 when I encountered it, it tickled me, probably because the dish itself was omnipresent in my house, and to see it travel the world kind of opened me up. How old were you when you discovered that tiny book?
I mean, I think I was reading it before I could read. I remember it always being in my life. And the book, it's a set of books from the Nutshell Library that are so small that it always just felt to me like, you know, a special secret just for kids.
Absolutely. So let's talk about class for a minute. You cite Gustave Flaubert's Sentimental Education with its wild descriptions of opulent meals as a favorite. Perhaps you could just read us a little snippet that you quoted in your article.
Yes. What's funny about this one is I remembered having read it the first time around, these opulent descriptions. And of course, the main character who originally comes from the country but has moved to Paris is sort of semi-horrified by the opulence. And I had this memory of when he's back in his hometown, there being like really wonderful descriptions of bread. And then I went back and reread it and that's not the case. So I must have sort of in my own thinking about class in this novel, I had sort of imagined what the food in his hometown would have been. But in any case, what the book actually contains and is very striking are these descriptions of these festivities. And you have one dinner party that's held in a huge room and it's, quote, hung with red damask and lit by a chandelier and candelabra. And then you see the sort of menu that the guests are served, and there's champagne-drenched sturgeon's head and roast quail and vol-au-vent bechamel and red-legged partridges and potatoes mixed with truffles, and it just goes on and on. And there's another scene where people are, like, you know, shooting long jets of wine at one another and birds are flying around. And so it's just this totally over the top, but very memorable descriptions.
I remember as a young person reading novel descriptions such as these and just being amazed that people lived these lives. There was something about learning about people through food in novels that I just ate up. Sorry. But it's true.
No, it's really interesting, though, because I actually didn't start noticing food in literature until much later. And I don't know why, but there was something about the first time I read The Wind-Up Bird Chronicle by Haruki Murakami. And this was after college. This was like, I don't know, I was in my 20s. And his descriptions of just these simply prepared but delicious sounding food just totally blew me away. And from then on, I became obsessed with, like, when I'd notice it in a novel or in other forms of reading, I would notice it. But to me, Murakami was sort of like this awakening for me.
Do you have an example for us from Murakami?
I do. Let me pull it up. This is so good. Okay, so this is from The Wind-Up Bird Chronicle. And the main character, Toru, is sort of waiting for his wife to come home from work. And here's the passage. At noon, I had lunch and went to the supermarket. There, I bought food for dinner and from a sale table, bought detergent, tissues, and toilet paper. At home again, I made preparations for dinner and lay down on the sofa with a book, waiting for Kumiko to come home. Not that I had any great feast in mind. I would be stir-frying thin slices of beef, onions, green peppers, and bean sprouts with a little salt, pepper, soy sauce, and a splash of beer, a recipe from my single days. The rice was done, the miso soup was warm, and the vegetables were all sliced and arranged in separate piles in a large dish ready for the wok. I just love that. It just sounds so good.
You say that his descriptions can take the mundane and make it somehow magical, take the real and warp it into a dream.
Right. And part of that is, you know, in the context of Murakami's writing writ large. And so you're in a novel that's already surreal and strange and you as the reader are sort of trying to get your bearings. And then you come across a passage like this where it's just like the guy goes to the store and buys toilet paper and then makes some stir fry. And it seems so ordinary, but it's beautifully described all while this very strange mystery is playing out in sort of the narrative arc.
You know, I love that you mentioned Brodigan because it's been so long since I've read him. And you talk about a scene in which he describes the intimacy of a cup of coffee.
Yes.
And how it allows the mind to kind of quietly roam.
Yes. I loved this because, I mean, I love Brodigan generally. And I loved this example because it's not just that descriptions of food and literature are memorable because they sound delicious. So much of it for me is being able to accurately capture the place that food occupies. And in this scene, in this story, it's the scene of a breakup or a man sort of going to visit his former lover and they have a cup of coffee. It's like instant coffee, nothing exciting. It really speaks to how food can be a crutch or just, you know, the ways in which food appears in our life that, again, seem ordinary but get sort of imbued with meaning.
And one of the things that I really love about what you described from Nora Ephron, you're talking about her description of making a ricotta pancake. My favorite part of that description is how she casually mentions the off-gassing from the Teflon pan.
I know. I know. She was so funny and so cool. And so reading the I remember the first time I read this essay of hers, and, you know, it ends with a recipe for this pancake. It's like, oh, I have to make this pancake and be like Nora Ephron. And of course, I tried and like did a terrible job and it wasn't very good. But you're right. Like the humor with her, it's always the sort of one-liner, the self-deprecation or just, she was so, so funny.
So funny. And like tempering the joy, like you couldn't just enjoy that ricotta pancake.
Right.
And for me, I mean, the quote from Italo Calvino, who you characterize as having a dreamer's eye, the way he describes the act of cooking, I think is one of the greatest descriptions ever of the act of cooking.
Yes, I love it. It totally captures the romance of how we think about food. And the way he describes it is this, the handing down of an intricate, precise lore. And for me, of course, as I was reading this, I was thinking about my Italian grandmother and all of the recipes that she, you know, that I was near her while she made and that I have now tried to make myself. And Calvino's writing about Mexican food, but it's really, it's the sense of the personal and the ancient, even for something as present tense as eating a meal.
Well, thank you so much, Adrian.
Thank you so much for having me.
That was Adrienne LaFrance, the executive editor of The Atlantic. You'll find a link to her essay, The 12 Most Unforgettable Food Scenes in Literature, on our website. Head to kcrw.com/goodfood. Are you hungry? Well, Bill Addison is here next with a recommendation for terrific Shanghainese food in San Gabriel. I'm Evan Kleiman, and this is Good Food. The San Gabriel Valley is a food lover's paradise of regional Chinese restaurants. Cantonese-style dim sum, Taiwanese soup dumplings, face-numbing Sichuan food. The East meets West cuisine of the Xinjiang region, which was a crucial thoroughfare along the Silk Road. But what about the food of Shanghai? Amidst all this regional splendor, it often gets overlooked, and it shouldn't. Los Angeles Times restaurant critic Bill Addison has a terrific Shanghainese spot to recommend, Wang Jia in San Gabriel. Hi, Bill.
Hi, Evan.
Why don't you start by telling us a little bit about Shanghai and its food? Where in the giant geography of China is it located?
Yes, we are talking about the Yangtze River Delta, the Jiangnan region in eastern China. It's an exceptionally fertile area, and it also encompasses the culinary traditions of many neighboring smaller cities. Fuchsia Dunlap wrote a cookbook a few years back about the region called Land of Fish and Rice, which I think is a title that introduces this area as good as any. It's often defined by its subtlety. Sometimes it has a reputation for sweetness to the flavors. And sometimes it also gets a rep for bland, like almost overly plain cooking. I don't agree with that. I think that there is subtlety and nuance to Shanghainese cuisine that I really appreciate in the same way that I appreciate Cantonese cuisine.
So what are some of the most famous dishes from the region, and will we find them at Wang Jia?
You will find some of them at Wang Jia. I mean, it's an enormous menu, but there are specialties like xiaolongbao, of course, the famous soup dumplings. And I'll be honest, I think that there are more interesting versions of that particular dish out there in the world. The red braised meats are very common in the Shanghai area, and lots of seafood dishes. And that's almost where I think you should put your attention here. But the important thing, and we can get into this, is to ask for guidance at this restaurant.
Yeah, I mean, whenever you walk into a place that you've never been before, where there's over 150 items on the menu, you really do need, guidance. So whose restaurant is it? Who's running it?
A woman named Lulu Luo. She has owned the restaurant for 3 years. She and her family are from Shanghai. And her son, Kevin Ma, they are the two that generally act as guides through an enormous 150-dish menu that also has plenty of Sichuan dishes on there. That caters to local tastes. I'm suggesting that you stick to their suggestions and ask for Shanghainese dishes.
So let's start with the Shan Ru Kai Fan, the fried rice with salt, pork, and greens. It looks so good in its simplicity.
It's really incredible. I had never quite had this dish before. And the thing that's so beautiful about it is the elegance of the seasoning. It is just those dishes, right? Very seasonal greens, a bit of pork, short grain rice. But something about the precise elegance of the seasoning almost makes the rice taste amplified. Like you appreciate its sweetness even more. It's fantastic.
So cold meats are traditionally a big part of the Shanghainese repertoire. How is that represented at Wang Jia?
They are absolutely present, and they are served a lot larger than some other restaurants where I've seen them. So if you're coming with a group, just settle in for a couple. I'd say the drunken chicken that's doused with a sherry-like wine, or the smoked fish, which is such an iconic flavor of that region. It's a little bony, but then you kind of navigate and you really enjoy those kind of meaty campfire sweet flavors that come through in the fish.
Tell us about their variations on Shanghai's shrimp and eel specialties.
There is a Shanghainese dish that I would love to find more in the United States. It's tiny crystalline shrimp fried with longjing, the prized green tea that comes first thing in spring. I've had it in Hong Kong and not anywhere locally, but they are serving a version of that dish without the tea leaves here. And it's actually really simple and delicious. And the shrimp have snap. They're kind of glassy almost. And then they have quite a few eel specialties as well. The one that I'm always being steered toward, they call it simply on the menu, braised minced eel in brown sauce. Very delicate, a bit of chives to offset the flavors, almost more about kind of the texture in the best possible way, kind of the thin, squiggly, noodle-like texture.
So I'm all about meatballs of kind of every type.
And yes.
And lion's head meatballs are another defining Shanghainese dish. How is it done here?
Yeah, these are some of the best I've had. They're enormous. And the meat has this kind of beautiful coarseness to it, though the texture is utterly lush, utterly tender. And they drape them in cabbage leaves and they bathe them in this brothy, very lightly thickened sauce that tastes slightly of ginger. It is wonderful. I think you would really, really appreciate this as part of the global meatball lexicon.
You have a very specific recommendation for the finale of your meal.
Yes, I do. It's a whole crab dissected and served in this sauce that tastes to me like they've incorporated crab roe into it. And it's full also of those orb-shaped rice cakes. Sometimes they call them rice sticks. And you get your hands in there and it's messy and a little chewy from the rice cakes and delicate and frilly from the crab meat. And it's just this kind of big, wonderful ending to a meal where you leave entirely satisfied and also ready to come back and see what else you can find on this enormous menu.
Oh, it sounds wonderful. Thank you so much, Bill.
Thank you, Evan.
That was LA Times restaurant critic Bill Addison talking about Wang Jia, a San Gabriel restaurant that specializes in the cuisine of Shanghai. You'll find it at the corner of East Las Tunas Drive and Mission Avenue. You can also read more about Wang Jia at our website. For a link to Bill's review, just go to kcrw.com/goodfood. If you missed any of today's show, listen at kcrw.com/goodfood or on KCRW's mobile app. You can also subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or Spotify. My thanks go out to the Good Food team, Jillian Ferguson, Laurel Garcia, Elena Shatkin, Desmond Taylor, Nick Lamponi, and PJ Shahamat. And special thanks to Chrissy Van Meter, Laura Kondarajan, and Gary Masiha. I'm Evan Kleiman, and I think I'll make some chicken soup with rice this weekend. I'll be back next week with an all-new episode of Good Food.